The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from the WGBB studios in Merrick, New York, this is Sports Talk New York.
All right, folks, we are back with Sports Talk New York here on WGBB Radio. That's Long Island's oldest radio station with Long Island's oldest host. 1240 AM, 95.9 FM, beautiful downtown Merrick, Long Island. We've spoken with Amazing Mets Art Shamsky, and now we're in the midst of what I termed in the open our cavalcade of authors. I'm kind of catching up on a list of guests that I've had to reschedule because of my recent illness, and I'm happy to welcome aboard tonight. So let us carry on, my wayward sons. In our next guest, he's a recognized researcher in the areas of sports media and intercollegiate athletics. He is a co-author of a sports public relations textbook, and he is preparing revisions for a fourth edition. His latest work is titled Jim Gilliam, The Forgotten Dodger. So please join me in welcoming to Sports Talk New York tonight, Steve Dittmore. Steve, good evening.
Good evening, Bill. How are you doing today?
We're doing fine. I hope you are as well, Steve. Now, before we discuss his life, why is Jim Gilliam the Forgotten Dodger?
Well, you know, it's funny. When the title came out and the publisher wanted that title, I heard from a lot of fans of the Brooklyn Dodgers that are on Facebook groups that I joined as part of the research process and tried to connect with some people. And they all said, oh, he is not forgotten by that group of people, people that grew up in Brooklyn in the 1950s, remember going to Ebbets Field, remember seeing Gilliam play. I think the reason why the title does work, though, is that Gilliam's body of work, playing in seven World Series between Brooklyn and Los Angeles, winning four World Series rings between Brooklyn and Los Angeles, being in the top 10 in a number of Dodgers statistical categories, including things like plate appearances, runs, and position player war, and he gets zero votes for the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't think about him when they talk about the Boys of Summer. I mean, he wasn't in Roger Kahn's book. You know, it's kind of head-scratching in a way that here was a guy that was the Rookie of the Year in 1953 in the National League, received or finished fifth in the National League MVP voting in 1956, and people don't talk about him the way they talk about Duke Snider or Pee Wee Reese or Carl Farrillo, Gil Hodges, and all those guys are great players. I'm not taking anything away from them. But Gilliam was in there day in and day out for the Dodgers for 11 years as a player in the organization for 27 years.
It's kind of a glaring omission, as you're mentioning in the book. Now, I would like to know, how did he get the nickname Junior?
So that nickname was given to him kind of by accident in spring training of 1946. He was trying out for the Baltimore Eli Giants. Gilliam had dropped out of high school in Nashville, Tennessee, and had played the 1945 season with the Nashville Black Vols in the Negro Southern League. And George Scales was the manager of the Baltimore Eli Giants, who used to be based in Nashville, and they still held their spring training in Nashville. And so they were in Nashville, and Gilliam was, you know, trying out for the team. And he couldn't swing, he couldn't hit a curveball. He was batting, he was a righty-righty. And Scales, as the manager, said, "Hey, Junior, why don't you get over the other side of the plate and try it from there?" And the nickname stuck. And Gilliam actually went on to become quite a proficient switch hitter as a result of that as well.
That's a great fact. I'm glad I asked that, Steve. Now,
As
we said, born in Nashville, dropped out of high school, joined the Nashville Black Vols of the Negro Southern League, 1945. Now, he was 16 years old?
Correct. Yep.
Wow, that is amazing. Tell us a little more about his time with the Nashville Black Vols.
Well, so very little is known actually about that. There are very few statistics that exist from the 1945 Negro Southern League. And there's a great book by William Plott that does the history of the Negro Southern League, and he even admits he can't find statistics. So we don't know much. We know he played third base. We know he was part of an all-star team that played a game against an industrial team in Birmingham because he was listed in a newspaper as being part of that. But we don't really know statistics. 46, he joins the Baltimore Eli Giants then as part of the Negro Leagues, and he doesn't see a whole lot of action. This is his age 17 season. So he's not seeing a whole lot of action. But by 1948, 49 and 50, he was an all-star in the Negro Leagues.
That was with the Baltimore Eli Giants, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Now, he was purchased by the Dodgers in 1950, October of 1950, and he went to Montreal, as so many of them did, from 51 to 52. How about his time with the Royals?
Yeah, so he had two great seasons in Montreal, and when the Dodgers purchased him, they also purchased Joe Black and another pitcher named Leroy Farrell for a sum of $11,000. And Black and Gilliam had been roommates throughout his time with the Baltimore Eli Giants. They were two kind of different personalities. Black actually graduated from Morgan State, so he was college educated. Gilliam had dropped out of high school, not finishing his senior year of high school. So they were a little different that way, but they got along great. They were good friends, and they go to Montreal together. And in 51, they stayed together as roommates and played on that team. Gilliam finished second in the MVP voting in the International League that year, behind Chico Fernandez, another member of the Montreal Royals.
Right.
And then in 1952, Black gets recalled or gets added to the Dodgers roster and becomes the Rookie of the Year for Brooklyn in 1952. Gilliam is still in the minors during that period of time, wins the International League MVP, and then would make his Major League debut in April 1953.
Right, 53, he's the National League Rookie of the Year for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Of course, he was a great ball player with Montreal. Was there a glaring need in Brooklyn for them to bring up Jim Gilliam?
Well, I think in hindsight, I think that kind of depends on who you're asking on this. I think
okay.
Here's my take on it. The Dodgers at that point in time, like every other big league club that had integrated, didn't have Black players on the bench. They had Black players in the lineup. So if you had, you know, Jackie Robinson, Roy Campanella, you had Willie Mays, you had Larry Doby, Monty Irvin. Those types of guys were playing every day. But you didn't have somebody on the bench who was Black. And so the Dodgers opted to keep a couple of middle infielders that were kind of journeymen, Bobby Morgan and Rocky Bridges, and kept those guys on the roster in 51 and 52 while Gilliam was putting up lights-out statistics in Montreal. And by as early as June of 1951, the New York Daily News was actually reporting about Gilliam and wondering if he could help Brooklyn in 1951. And so you can't help but think in hindsight, if there hadn't been kind of a quota at that point in time, that maybe Gilliam could have helped the Dodgers win one game in 1951 that would have avoided a three-game playoff with the New York Giants, or maybe help them win one more game in the World Series in 52, and maybe that becomes the year they beat the Yankees instead of 55.
Amazing thought, Steve. Yeah, that they could have avoided the playoff with the New York Giants. Imagine that, folks. No Bobby Thompson and no shot heard around the world because of potentially Jim Gilliam's play with the Dodgers. Now, was there a feeling in Brooklyn, Steve? We're speaking with Steve Ditmore tonight about his book, The Forgotten Dodger, Jim Gilliam. Was there a pervasive feeling in Brooklyn? Now, they have the 1952 and 1953 Rookies of the Year. Is there a feeling there that they're really building a firm basis for the future?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, there was a lot of newspaper coverage, you know, doing the archive research on this. You see a lot of newspaper coverage about Gilliam being groomed to replace Jackie Robinson because Jackie was getting older. And, you know, he would be the person to move Jackie Robinson off that, and then he would be the foundation for the future. you know, Robinson obviously still played through the 56 season, so he wasn't ready to hang it up when Gilliam debuted. And there were other young players, young infielders that the Dodgers had in their system. Don Zimmer was an integral part of the 55 World Series winning team. Charlie Neal came along around that same time. So there were a lot of these guys that could play second, short, third base. Gilliam was primarily a second baseman, third baseman, but moved to the outfield. And so they were building this foundation of younger players to eventually replace Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson and some of the other mainstays that went back to the late 40s.
As you mentioned earlier, Steve, a great point on the resume of Jim Gilliam is that he played on 7 World Series teams, and the Dodgers won 4 of those between Brooklyn and L.A. Now, wouldn't you think that that would be enough to garner some interest in the folks at Cooperstown?
Well, yeah, you would think so. And I think, you know, looking back on it, hindsight being what it is, you know, when he came out and he finally retired, so he retired twice at the end of the 64 season. He retired, well, actually 3 times at the end of the 65 season because he got reactivated in 65. He got reactivated again in 66. He finally retired in 66, which made him eligible for the Hall of Fame at the same time that Sandy Koufax was eligible for the Hall of Fame because he also retired at the end of the 66 season. So it's easy to think that he got overlooked a little bit. But I'll say this about those 4 World Series. He's the only player in Dodger history to appear in 4 World Series winners for the Dodgers. Koufax was on the roster in 55, but he didn't play in that series. Johnny Padres was actually still on the roster in 65, but didn't play in that World Series. Gilliam was the only one to play in 55, 59, 63, and 65.
I don't know if Ted Williams was on the committee or to bring Jim Gilliam into the Hall of Fame, or is that just the writer's ballot then? I don't think he was ever considered by a veterans committee, was he?
To the best of my knowledge, no. And I interviewed some people, some writers, national writers like Jay Jaffe and Adam Dalowski that write a lot about this stuff and have done a lot of archival research and trying to compare players from different eras and that sort of thing. And both of them are just surprised that Jim Gilliam never received a single vote for the Hall of Fame. In fact, Jay Jaffe called it one of the biggest slights. The other person that I would put right up there with that is longtime Los Angeles Dodger outfielder Willie Davis, mm-hmm. who played throughout the 60s and 70s. He never received the Hall of Fame vote. And he's, you know, top 10 in a bunch of Dodger career statistics as well and was an integral part of those World Series teams in 63, 65, 66.
A great outfielder, Willie Davis, folks. You can Google him, take a look at Willie Davis' career, great center fielder. Now, I had always heard, Steve, that on the veterans, there was only one veterans committee a while ago when Ted served on it, but I had always heard that there was a feeling that there were too many Brooklyn Dodgers in the Baseball Hall of Fame. This always kept Gil Hodges out as well, because the overwhelming feeling was that there's too many of those guys in the Hall of Fame now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Carl Erskine, before he passed away, I think, you know, he was quoted a lot by saying, well, we should put the entire 53 team, because the 53 team was so good at the beginning, mm-hmm. we should put the entire 53 team in the Hall of Fame, or put the 55 team in there. They all deserved it. And Gil Hodges absolutely deserved it. Carl Erskine's not in the Hall of Fame.
No.
You know, so there are, yeah, you look at that, and there's, what, 6 Dodgers? I mean, Campanella, Robinson, Snyder, Reese, Hodges, Koufax, if we want to count Koufax in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, from that 55 team, there's quite a few.
Exactly. Yeah, there's a good case right there, Steve. Steve Ditmore with us tonight. Jim Gilliam is the topic. Now, he was the only player in baseball history to hit a homer in the Negro League's East-West All-Star Game and in the Major League All-Star Game. Now, there's a stat.
Yeah, and I stumbled upon that, and I double, triple checked myself to make sure that was the case before I put it in print. But it is. I mean, you think about the other players that were hitting home runs in the Negro League's East-West All-Star Game in the 40s, people like Buck Leonard, Josh Gibson, and those types. They never had a chance to play in the majors. And then you look at other players from the late 40s in the Negro Leagues that did go into the majors, guys like Hank Aaron, Ernie Banks, Willie Mays.
Right.
They never homered in the East-West All-Star game. So Gilliam in 1950 hits one off of Vibert Clark, who was a member of the Memphis team. And in 1959 in the Los Angeles Coliseum, he hits one off of Baltimore Orioles pitcher Billy O'Dell, lost one over the screen in Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum, and he's the only person to do that.
That is amazing. That is an amazing statistic. And I'm so glad that you added that into the book, because I'd love to be able to tell people that. That is a great statistic. Now,
and the funny thing is, he wasn't a home run hitter. That's the other ironic
thing.
I think he had like 65, 67 career home runs in the majors. So, yeah.
That is wonderful. Now, Jackie always talked about having a black face in the third base coaching box. Now, Jim Gilliam was the first black base coach in Major League Baseball history. There's another great piece of trivia for people to use.
Mm-hmm.
That is great. Now, it's surprising that there were none other.
Yeah, you know, he's only the third black coach in Major League history. So Buck O'Neill and Gene Baker were both coaches prior to Gilliam being named coach after the 64 season ended. So Gilliam was kind of forced into retirement by the Dodgers. He had statistically his worst season of his career in 1964. There's no doubt the Dodgers slumped tremendously after sweeping the Yankees in 63 in the World Series. And Gilliam was an integral part of those teams. He scored the winning run in the deciding game. And Gilliam has a poor season in 64. The Dodgers had Leo DeRocher as a coach. Leo DeRocher was going to move on from that role, and so the Dodgers said, we're going to make Gilliam our first base coach. And it wasn't even a big deal at that point in time. But Gene Baker with the Pirates, Buck O'Neill with the Cubs, had each spent 1 year as a bench coach with those teams. But they were never one of those that were on the field. You know, you cited Jackie Robinson talking about a black face in the third base coaching box.
Mm-hmm.
Gilliam was the first black face to be on the field as a coach. And he did that, and he held that role from on and off 65, 66, those first two seasons, until full-time in 67 through his death in 1978.
Now, you know a lot about the Dodgers. Maybe it's through your research, Steve, but did you grow up a Dodger fan?
I did. I was born in Redondo Beach, California in the late 60s and grew up watching the 1970s Dodgers, and that was what got me hooked.
Ah, okay. So Ron Fairley, as you say, Willie Davis, guys like that.
Yeah.
Those guys
preceded me a little bit. I was more on the Steve Garvey, Ron Say, Dusty Baker,
okay.
Reggie Smith.
Yeah, you see, I grew up with Wes Parker and guys like that in the 70s, early 70s, late 60s. So we're a little bit off in age, but great.
Well, I interviewed Wes Parker for this. He was tremendous. He had some great stories to tell about Jim Gilliam. Really liked him as an individual. Was part of that all switch hitting infield in the 1965 season with Jim LaFever and Maury Wills, and then those two.
One of the two Dodgers to be on the Brady Bunch as well, Steve. Don't forget that. That's an important piece right there, too.
Was Drysdale the other one?
Yes, Drysdale, who's on Leave It to Beaver and a couple of other shows. And that's another great piece of trivia, but we'll leave that alone for now. Now, Jim Gilliam, as you mentioned, top 10 in Dodgers all-time categories.
Yeah.
Now,
so he's there. Oh, God. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to know if you know some of the categories where he's in there.
So, I mean, he's going to be top 10 in plate appearances, runs scored, walks, games played, things of that nature. Overall hits, but, you know, he didn't hit for a ton of power. He had a really good bat-to-ball skill, so he walked quite a bit, walked about twice as much as he struck out, so he had really good eye at the plate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mentioned position player war. I think he's tied for eighth with a career position player war of 40.7, I believe, off the top of my head for Gilliam. So he's in a lot of those categories. He's not in the RBIs category. He's not in the home runs category, extra base hits, slugging percentage, some of those things. But he did a lot of the little things to help the Dodgers win. And I think that was one of the things that came through in just about everybody I spoke with, was that he was a high baseball IQ person, never made the wrong play, never went to the wrong base or threw inappropriately to try and do more than he could or more than the situation called for. And I think that's what really made him part of that glue for the, all of those teams, because he started more opening days on the bench for the Dodgers. He was not in more in all that many opening day lineups, and he played third base, he played second base, he played left field. In fact, he logged innings at first base and in center field and in right field. So he played all over the diamond for the Dodgers.
When you consider some of the players that have passed through the portals of the Dodger franchise, that is an amazing stat that Jim Gilliam is top 10 in several categories. That really is telling right there, Steve. Now, I know the Dodgers, I believe, that they wait until a player is in the Hall of Fame before they retire their number. Is that correct?
Well, that's kind of correct for most of 1980s, 1990s, in that period of time. They retired Gilliam's number when he passed away. They announced it at the funeral service on October 10th, 1978.
Yeah.
And they did that, and I interviewed Peter O'Malley, Walter O'Malley's son, who was president of the Dodgers at that time. And, you know, he makes the point, and this was a time when Gil Hodges, is 14, wasn't retired. I interviewed O'Malley in 2020, as a part of this research. And he told me, you know, we didn't think about that at that point in time. You've got to understand the context. We looked at a guy that had been in the organization for 27 years, was a company man that did everything that we wanted out of someone affiliated with the Dodgers organization. And at that point in time, the only Dodgers who had their numbers retired were Robinson, Campanella, Koufax, and Walter Alston, the manager from, the mid-50s to the mid-70s.
Right.
Those were the only four. So there wasn't any precedent. The Dodgers retired Hodges' number after he was elected to the Hall of Fame, and they've subsequently retired Fernando Valenzuela's 34, even though Fernando's not in the Hall of Fame. Mm-hmm. So Gilliam and Fernando now are the two Dodger players to have their numbers retired, not in Cooperstown.
As you say, a company man who did a lot for the franchise, sort of in the same vein as Nuke, as Don Newcomb.
Yeah, those guys, I mean, they played, a lot of years together with the Dodgers organization. And then, yeah, Newcomb went on to work for the Dodgers organization for a number of years, even doing so after Gilliam passed away in the late 70s. I think Newcomb was there in the 80s and the 90s, all the way up till his death, I think, right?
Yes, yes. He was an integral part of the organization right until the end. And a credit to the man. Now, Jim passes in 1978 as a result of a cerebral hemorrhage. What did Jim Gilliam do when he left the game?
I mean, other than coach, he did that during the season. In the off season, he played a heck of a lot of golf, it seems like, from what I can understand. I did talk with his widow, Edwina, and two of his four children, agreed to be interviewed. And, we talked about how he liked to play golf. He got a job like a lot of players did in the off seasons, got jobs outside of baseball. And so he worked as a spokesperson, salesperson for Hiram Walker Spirits in the Los Angeles area, did quite a bit of community service work. I mean, I found plenty of instances where he would be appearing at a car dealership to sign autographs and things of that nature. So he was very visible in the community, played in a lot of those pro-am golf tournaments that Los Angeles has, the Byron Nelsons and the other things like that are in the Los Angeles area. Mm-hmm. I think Byron Nelsons there, I might be misspeaking on that. But, those types of golf events that occur, played a lot of that and, really was just a baseball lifer. I mean, that's the only thing that he did. The only job that I could find that he had as a kid outside of baseball was he worked as a porter at the Woolworth store in Nashville, the one that subsequently became part of the National Historical Registry, for the lunch counter sit-ins that took place later on at that Woolworth.
Ah, there's another great statistic. Yeah, another great fact. Now, 0% for the Hall of Fame vote.
Yeah, I don't know how to explain it.
Did you talk to anybody in Cooperstown for the research, Steve?
I didn't talk to anybody with the Hall of Fame or with the committees about that. I'm hopeful that the book at least has. I've been gratified to do a bunch of interviews and just different discussions with baseball researchers and things like that. So I'm hopeful that there's some attention that is brought to the fact that maybe a veterans committee should consider him. And to be clear, I don't necessarily think that his body of work warrants a position in Cooperstown, but I certainly think he warranted, at the time that he retired, he warranted a conversation and warranted being on at least one person's ballot.
Consideration. Yes, definitely,
yes.
Steve. Yeah. Now, you took part in the author series up in Cooperstown.
I did not.
Oh, you didn't? I thought you... Okay, yeah, I'm sorry. No. That must be one of the other guys on the show tonight. But,
yeah, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Do you have anything upcoming, Steve?
Nothing else that is planned. I did make a... I had a panel discussion with Bob Kendrick, the executive director and president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum in Kansas City.
Right.
A few weeks back when they did their salute to the Negro Leagues. The Royals were actually playing the Dodgers, and I live in Jacksonville, Florida right now, and I flew from Jacksonville to Kansas City and participated in a 30-minute conversation with Bob Kendrick about the book, about Jim Gilliam's life and about his role in the Negro Leagues. There were several people, probably 100 or so people that were still in attendance there, a lot of Dodger fans that had come in for the series that were there before that game. The game was at like 4 o'clock that afternoon, so this was at like 12 o'clock on a Saturday that we did that. But that was the most recent. I did a signing at the Nashville Sounds game when they did a throwback to the Negro Leagues the week before that in June. As part of Black History Month, the Nashville Sounds had me out there, which is, the ballpark in Nashville is at 19 Junior Gilliam Way. It was renamed that several years ago.
Ah, that is very interesting, too. Yes. Now, did you speak with Bob Kendrick about Jim's chances for the Negro League Hall of Fame?
We didn't discuss that. That didn't come up in topic. We talked about... We talked about, the challenges that black players faced and, just kind of the overall. And, I don't know if you've ever had a chance to listen to Bob, but he's a phenomenal storyteller.
I've had him on the show, Steve. Yeah,
he is such a gracious person. I can't say enough of good things about him.
Great. And the whole Negro League Hall of Fame is a great institution. And love to have Bob on the program. As you say, a great speaker, great storyteller. Well, Steve Ditmore, it's been a pleasure speaking with you tonight. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to spend it with us here, a few miles east of Brooklyn, out here on Long Island. The book, folks, it's titled Jim Gilliam, The Forgotten Dodger. And once again, Steve, we thank you.
Bill, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking with you. I appreciate it.
That is Steve Ditmore, ladies and gentlemen. Up next on Sports Talk New York, we will delve into the Interstate World Series of 1985 with author Marshall Garvey. Stay with us, folks.
Listening to Sports Talk New York. Tune in every Sunday night at 8 p.m. on Long Island's WGBB. Broadcasting on 95.9 FM and 1240 AM. Or listen live online at WGBBRadio.com. Stay connected to Sports Talk New York on WGBB by following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at WGBB Sports Talk. You're listening to Sports Talk New York on Long Island's WGBB. And now, back to the show.
All right, folks, we're back. We're back on Sports Talk New York, WGBB Radio, Merrick, Long Island, New York is where we are at. We're winding down on our cavalcade of authors tonight on the show. Some great books to support your summertime reading habits, folks. So we want to remind you, as it's the topic of our show so often throughout the year, Cooperstown 2025, the induction weekend, what I've termed in the past as Woodstock for baseball, taking place in really the epitome of small town USA, Cooperstown, New York. That'll be next weekend, July 25th to 27th, and entering into the hallowed shrine through the portals for immortals, as I call it. Dick Allen, Dave Parker, CC Sabathia, Billy Wagner, and Ichiro Suzuki will be inducted. Allen and Parker posthumously. Dave Parker, unfortunately, it's a real shame, missed his induction just by weeks. I wonder who will be giving the speeches for Dick and for Dave. And I'm wondering if Ichiro will be giving his own speech or if he'll have a pinch hitter. We'll wait to see that. We shall see. Coverage will be next Sunday, the 27th, on the MLB Network. Brian Kenny from MLB usually handles the MC duties, and I'm assuming he will return to Cooperstown this year, and that's all. We will forge ahead now. Our next guest work has appeared in Dodgers Nation, the Sacramento Bee, 80s Baseball, Screen Rant, and many other venues. He's the author of two books, The Hidden History of Sacramento Baseball and Elwood's Odyssey, which is a novel of historical fiction. His latest book is titled Interstate 85. That's the year 85, folks. The Royals, the Cardinals, and the Show Me World Series. I welcome to Sports Talk New York tonight, Marshall Garvey. Marshall, good evening.
Bill, great to hear from you. I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful to have you, Marshall. Now, I want you to give us a little background on where you grew up and who were your teams and heroes.
Well, I'm a lifelong Californian. I was born in Southern California, but I've lived north in the state most of my life, chiefly in Sacramento.
Mm-hmm.
So growing up, I'm from a Dodgers family. My dad's been a fan since 1970. I'm not related to Steve, by the way. everyone always asks. growing up, obviously loved the Dodgers. Went to a lot of Oakland Athletics games. Sure to miss that. Favorite players growing up would be I also really liked the Twins when I was young. That's kind of a foreshadowing of the all Midwest tenor of this book. So I liked Kirby Puckett. I liked Torrey Hunter.
Uh-huh.
Those were some of my favorite players as a kid. That's the Cliff Notes background of my early life in baseball in the early 2000s.
Gotcha. Yeah, see, with the Twins, I go back to Harmon Killebrew, Tony Oliva, Bob Allison, Don Mincher. There's a great name, for a great baseball name for you guys out there. The Southern California, we just spoke to a gentleman, Steve Ditmore, about his book on Junior Gilliam, so we discussed a lot about the Dodgers. Now, for uninitiated New York fans, Marshall, just elaborate on the I-70 and Show Me. What are we talking about there for guys who may not know what we're talking about?
Well, that's a reference to, first off, Interstate 70.
Right.
That's the interstate highway that runs through Missouri, and it's connected Kansas City and St. Louis either partially or entirely since 1956.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where the World Series in 85 got its name, the I-70 series. Also, Missouri is known as the Show Me State.
There you go.
It goes back to some kind of quote that someone said, like, I'm from Missouri, you have to show me, you know, just kind of like a pledge of prove it to me, be honest. So that's where the I-70 and Show Me series nicknames basically come from.
Fine. Yeah, that's great to let people know that. Especially here in New York. Now, the book really is a blend of baseball and cultural history. You combine the two great 85 pop culture. Let's talk a little bit about that, Marshall.
For sure. Well, especially in the book's intro, A View to a Call, which is, you know, a pun, the reference to the James Bond movie and Duran Duran song that came out that year in 85. 1985 is arguably the greatest year in pop culture history. It's like, where do you begin and where do you end? You've got Live Aid, Back to the Future, the beginning of Moonlighting and Golden Girls, the founding of Studio Ghibli, the Nintendo Entertainment System basically saved video games as we know it. Tons of great pop music, Bruce Springsteen, Madonna, Aha, Tears for Fears, George Michael, and beyond. And in sports, probably was the single greatest thing in 85. You had so many great events, the Hagler-Hearns War in boxing, Mike Tyson's pro debut, first WrestleMania, the first NBA draft lottery, Michael Jordan's NBA Rookie of the Year. I'd go on and on. And, of course, one of the great moments and the one that captivated me the most, Don Denkinger's call and the I-70 World Series.
Oh, boy. We'll get to that, certainly, Marshall. Now, there you go, folks. It's not just a baseball book. You'll reminisce about, as we spoke about, 85 pop culture and the great things that happened in entertainment and in music and movies back in 1985, along with this World Series. Now, that highway I-70, it links the two teams' home cities, but the individual roads traveled by the players and other people who took part in that event before and after the series began and after the last cheers faded.
Yeah, that's the primary purpose of the book. I seized on that imagery of Interstate 70, and turned it into a book about the metaphorical roads of the Royals, the Cardinals, and Don Denkinger, both collectively and individually. Like, again, where they went to, how they got to 85, what happened during that World Series, and how those roads went in interesting directions in the years after, which is really interesting, you know, because the 85 series really largely faded from memory outside of Missouri, but it had a way of echoing throughout the years, and it goes all the way up to 2014 and 15, when the Royals finally got good again, and they finally won the World Series again in 15. And so the book, yeah, just explores how all these unique paths from 85 went in all these interesting directions and repeated throughout the years, and it all came full circle 30 years later.
Right, how the series began and how these players who, as we said, took part in the World Series, how they ended up. Now, we're speaking with Marshall Garvey tonight, his book about the 1985 World Series. Now, I read 27 interviews conducted by you, Marshall, including Brett, Ozzy, Denkinger himself, Bud Black, Van Slyke, Mark Gubiza. Tell us about some of these interviews and some of your favorites.
Oh, gosh. Yes, all 27 interviews were an absolute delight from the big names. Yeah, like George, especially on the Cooperstown note, George Brett and Ozzie Smith, Hall of Famers. Mm-hmm. Even really obscure guys. Honestly, all interviews were great. And you see they have big, strong points throughout the book. But I will say it's the lesser-known or even forgotten guys that made for the best stories. I'm talking guys like Joe Beckwith, Royals relief pitcher. I talked to him 2 weeks before he died of colon cancer, and he told me an incredible story about how Sandy Koufax turned his season around in 1985, a story I'm pretty sure he never told anyone else, and it's so beautiful. I talked to Kurt Kepshire, a Cardinals pitcher left off the playoff roster, but he poured his heart out to me about watching the Cardinals lose Game 5. They could have clinched the championship right there at home. Mm-hmm. But he feels a sense of guilt that he didn't get to pitch that game, and he believes that if he had, the Cardinals would have won.
Wow.
And there's so many others. Lynn Jones, Royals backup, very, very colorful and fluid storyteller. He talked about looking over at the opposing dugouts. For those who don't know the Royals, this is another one of many interesting things about the 85 Royals. They are the only team in MLB history to have 2 3-1 series comebacks in the same postseason. And Lynn Jones told me during both comebacks against the Blue Jays in the ALCS and the Cardinals in the World Series, he looked over, and with each game, he could see a look of defeat growing on the opposing team's face, their faces. So those are some of those are just a handful. We'd be here for hours and hours. Like, all these stories were so amazing across all 27 interviews. They all filled out the narrative in unique ways. It was like some of the lesser known players or even non players, like Royals bat boy Chris Brown. Like, he had great behind the scenes stories, including how he ended up keeping Joaquin Andujar's Game 7 jacket, which he still has to this day.
Wow.
It's stories like that really make this book leap. You know, it's not just a recounting of 85. It's a deep narrative, and these interviews were just a blast.
Oh, I can imagine. How did you get in touch with some of these guys, the lesser-known guys especially, Marshall?
That would come through a variety of ways. Some are really easy. Some have publicly listed email addresses or Facebook friends. I've been Facebook friends with Jim Sundberg for a while, added Buddy Biancolana there.
Mm-hmm.
Others took some digging. Steve Farr's wife works in real estate, so I emailed her through there. Kirk Kepshire's son is a doctor out in Colorado, so I messaged him on Instagram, and that got that rolling. It would come in a different ways. Frank White, Royal second baseman, is a politician in Kansas City, so I had to send a request through the Jackson County government website. George Brett was surprisingly easy. I just asked a sports journalist in KC for his number, or to get through to him, and George Brett just said, boom, here's my number. So it took, you know, it would take a little bit of time to get certain ones at certain times, but I had to go through a wide variety of ways to get all 27, but ultimately they were all willing to talk, and chasing down each interview was really exciting.
It must have been, yeah, and then to get the interview and to get the information, what a prize. And I'd just like to know what the Hall of Famers Brett and Ozzie Smith were able to give you.
Oh, no, they gave me plenty of great stuff. Well, Ozzie and I had a great chat about him growing up as a Dodgers fan. I mean, obviously I'm a Dodgers fan too, and it's a perfect prelude because Ozzie killed the Dodgers in the 1985 NLCS. He was MVP of that series. He told me one of his favorite players as a kid was Billy Grabarkovich.
Ah,
I mean, that's a deep cut, a one-season wonder. If that tells you what a fan Ozzie is, if he could drop a name like that.
Yeah,
I've
met Billy Grabarkovich, Marshall. I took a business trip to, he lives in Dallas, and he has a business in Dallas, and I had a game-used bat of his because I like the old Adirondack big sticks with the colored ring around them. I had one of Billy's, so I figured, let me try to, as you know, try to get in touch with this guy. And this was before the Internet. And I was able to get through to him, and we met one day, and he signed my bat for me. We took a photo together. I'll have to send you that. And as you said, a one-hit wonder. I voted for him for the All-Star game that year. That was the times when you had the punch cards, the computer punch cards that you had to punch out the guy you were voting for. And I remember I voted for Billy Grabarkovich because I voted strictly not on reputation, but on the kind of season the guy was having. And I remember voting for him, for Clarence Gaston, and guys like that, because I felt they were deserving. But, yeah, you mentioned Billy Grabarkovich, and that's funny. If I see Ozzie in Cooperstown this week, I will mention that to him. That is amazing.
Isn't that? Yeah, definitely bring it up. Ozzie just, I was tickled by that, too. Yeah, and that was one of my favorite bits from him.
Yeah.
And with George Brett, he gave a lot of good stuff. In particular, I loved how Brett, you'll notice, takes center stage in the last chapter of the book about 2014 and 15.
Uh-huh.
When the Royals are finally good again and they're in the World Series and they win it. And Brett just had a lot of really beautiful things to say about that. He had a lot of pride talking about, you know, when I asked him, like, what was it like seeing all your old teammates come back to Kauffman Stadium to see these playoffs? And he said to me, like, well, once a Royal, you'll die a Royal. And I thought that was really cool. George also told a great story about giving a speech at the 2015 parade, calling the 2015 team the best ever. I really liked the uniqueness of that perspective. So yeah. George and Ozzie had a lot of great bits, but those were some of the standouts from those two.
Nice. Great stories, Marshall. We're speaking with Marshall Garvey tonight about his book, I-85 and the Show Me World Series, back in 1985. 27 interviews, two Hall of Famers, some amazing names like Van Slyke, Gubiza. You'll really enjoy it. Now, let's talk about, unfortunately, the thing that most people recall about that World Series thing, Marshall, is the Don Denkinger missed call, which happened unfortunately defined Don Denkinger after that. Set the stage for us on that memorable event.
Of course. So it's Game 6 of the 85 World Series. It's at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, and the Cardinals are leading the series 3-2. It's a tight pitcher's duel. Game 6 is like sweat out of your armpits, just every moment elevated, so tense. But the Cardinals managed to take a lead, a 1-0 lead in the 8th, and they're only 3 outs away from clinching their 10th championship.
Mm-hmm.
Humongous milestone. Except leading off the 9th, George Orta, aging pinch hitter for the Royals, facing Todd Worrell, heat-throwing rookie sensation for the Cardinals. Orta taps the grounder to the right side, and it's a slow and really kind of weird play. George Brett said that to me. It's just not a smooth play. But regardless, the ball is fielded clearly in time to get Orta out at first. One problem. First base umpire Don Denkinger got way too close in his observation. He viewed the play in two parts, and the crowd noise was just ear-splitting. He could not hear the pop, pop, you know, ball and glove foot on the bag like he usually does. So he sees it. He calls it as he sees it, like an umpire should. Calls Orta safe, and especially to all younger listeners, this is well before instant replay was implemented. The call just stands. Even though it was obvious to almost everyone, and the televised replay show, Orta was out. All the same, it was just the first play, and from there on was just a parade of Royal heroics and Cardinal miscues that culminated in a walk-off hit by Dane Orge of the Royals. Then Kansas City trounces St. Louis 11-0 in Game 7 to take the title the following day.
Oh, wicked. And you were able to talk to Don about this play. I'm curious, what did George Brett have to say about it?
Oh, well, George is one of the many interviews I quote describing reactions to the call. George said, George said he wasn't sure if Orta was out, because he said, and George is right about this, it's not a fluid play.
Right.
He was saying it like in denial. George just honestly thought in the moment, he couldn't tell, it seemed a little off. But then later, George obviously saw the truth, you know, that he was out. But, you know, George, and I agree with him and many others, like at the end of the day, it's just one play and the Cardinals still should have handled their business. But that was basically, and George also puts a lot of emphasis on like, well, you still have a Game 7 to play. So that was basically his reaction when I talked to him about the call.
Right. It was a monumental collapse. Let's put it, call a spade a spade by the St. Louis Cardinals. And one line I heard from the whole situation, Marshall, was when Whitey went out the next night, and he made a pitching change, and he got tossed because he said to Don Denkinger, "We wouldn't even be here if it wasn't for you."
Right, and Denkinger, and I quote this in the book, and Denkinger shot back, "Well, if your team wasn't hitting like 150, we wouldn't be here either."
Whoa.
And Herzog responded with a stream of a big tirade, including some obscene name calling. So Herzog got tossed, and then Joaquin Andujar, who nearly physically assailed Denkinger a few pitches later, he got tossed. So that was a very ignominious inning for the Cardinals.
Yeah, and like I said, unfortunately, these events define that World Series almost. Let's talk about the interview you had with Don. How did you get through to him, and tell us about the conversation?
Oh, wonderful story. So Don was, this was early 2021. I already got my first two interviews, Buddy Biancolana and Mark Gubazov, back-to-back days.
Mm-hmm.
And my original publisher was really pushing for Jankinger, which is right. If I'm going to write the Ultimate 85 series book, I have to talk to Don.
Right.
I got all this contact info from Dan Green of Sports Illustrated, who wrote an article about the call in 2015 for SI. And it's a story in of itself, but I was really apprehensive, really nervous, and then I took it the day I was trying. I kept delaying it, like, I'm not going to call Don. I kept looking for excuses. I watched my favorite video game channel. I just listened to music. I was like, I'm not going to call. Then I took a nap, and I had a nightmare that I botched calling him. So I got up. It just went through my post-nap days, called Don. He answered and said yes, and we talked the following day, which was Valentine's Day 2021.
Okay.
Don, this is by phone, by the way. Don was joined by his wife, Gail, and two of their daughters, Denise and Dana, and the conversation was a joy.
Wow.
They're a super, super sweet family. Don was a great guy. And I talked about the call, but I asked him more about other stuff, like, how did you meet your wife, Gail? How'd you get into umpiring? Tell me about some other feats in your career. And he really liked that.
Yeah.
And the family liked that, too. So it was really sweet. Unfortunately, Don passed in 2023, so he didn't get to read the book, but his family has absolutely been loving it. So I'm glad I made that connection.
Yeah, it's great that they saw, Marshall, that you weren't there to hammer him. You know, you were there, you were interested in his life, in his story, and not just the call.
Exactly. Yeah, and that was one of that's the overall purpose of the book. You know, I do the call justice, but I tell a larger story beyond the call with all these other moments and players that got overlooked and Don himself. I show that he was a great guy and a great umpire. It was more than just one mistake.
As we said in the book, folks, the individual and collective roads traveled by the players and other folks who took part in the series, both during the series and later in their life, which we find out about Don Denkinger. And unfortunately, as Marshall said, passed away 2 years after they spoke. What else is happening with the book, Marshall? Tell us about that.
Oh, well, the book is doing great. I'm on podcasts or Saber presentations or in-person presentations and radio shows just about every week. I even got to attend the 1985 Royals 40th anniversary reunion in Kansas City, so I got to meet these guys in person.
Wow.
Which was, still haven't come down from that night. there's a lot going on. Right now, I am all in on pushing for a paperback edition for the book.
Uh-huh.
And then as soon as that's locked in, I will pivot to focusing on getting an audiobook. So, this book has, so to speak, a long road ahead of promotion.
It's got legs.
Go ahead.
It's got legs.
Yeah. It's got legs.
Yeah.
It's got legs. People have been loving it. I had someone recently tell me it was one of the best books they'd ever read, and he compared me to David Halberstam, which I just blew my mind. So
wow, yeah.
That was his words, not mine. So, yeah, but the book is doing really well, and, you know, again, I love talking about it, love sharing it with everyone. So, yeah, all in on the paperback for now, and then much more to come after that.
What would you say, Marshall Garvey with us tonight, is the epilogue of the whole story, of the whole series? And basically, what did we learn, and what's the final word?
The epilogue, and I traced this in detail in the book's last two chapters, but the epilogue is basically the 85 series was of great consequence to the Royals and Cardinals because they ended up going through some tribulation before they won their next championships years, decades later, especially the Royals. They had a lot of bad years.
Mm-hmm.
But the main thing with the epilogue is you see how Don Denkinger learns to embrace life with the call. He even starts going to Cardinal events. He goes to a Royals reunion in 2015. I think the epilogue ultimately is that for all the bitterness over the call, the 85 World Series was a tremendous chapter in baseball history that had so much more to appreciate, and that in the decades since, 40 years later especially, everything's come full circle. The people from that World Series have gone on to live great lives long after they left the game. Denkinger himself lived out a great life before passing away. The Royals and Cardinals both have won World Series since then. So the epilogue ultimately is a pretty optimistic one. You know,
mm-hmm.
it shows how legacies and fates from a specific World Series can go in some unplanned directions and can ripple for decades after the fact. And that's basically the long and short of it.
Well
and
said.
I was really, again, honored to talk to so many of these people and capture their legacies all these years later.
Well said, Marshall. Now, I also read somewhere that Don Denkinger at these events was welcomed by Cardinal fans.
He sure was. Well, he did like an autograph signing in 2004, the day after the Cardinals clinched the pennant. And he went to like 20th anniversary reunion for the 85 Cardinals. You know, and there would be some events where he'd maybe get a few boos, but overall fans warmed up to him. He would sign memorabilia. He'd sign like an eye chart, you know, poking fun at him. Yeah, he learned to have fun with it. And so, yeah, he became kind of a beloved villain, like Mirror more or less in St. Louis for some people. It's an interesting arc. I don't think anyone would have seen that coming in 85, but yeah, he learned to embrace it. I thought that was really sweet.
No, a happy ending. A happy ending. That's for sure for Don. And as I spoke earlier with Chris Donnelly about the 2000 Subway Series between the Mets and the Yankees, and paralleling with your book, the events are what makes baseball baseball.
Absolutely, and that's I'm really I found it so poetic that you talked to both Chris and I in the same show about these hyper-provincial World Series,
right?
And what they mean, like I remember the Subway Series. That's the year I got into baseball, 2000. What that meant to that whole city.
Right.
Same thing with 85. It wasn't just loved by Kansas City and St. Louis. The most remote, nothing towns in Missouri were living and dying with every pitch.
Yeah.
It was a cultural event for Missouri as a whole. And I love that. It goes to show that baseball and the World Series really is more than just a game. It's a transcendent event historically. And I think my book, and I'd like to read Chris's too, really shows that.
Yeah, and the way you parallel the culture of the times, the music, the movies, the politics, everything really falls right in line with it, then you did a tremendous job there, Marshall.
Thank you. Really appreciate that.
Well, Marshall Garvey, I appreciate you coming on the show tonight, taking time out of your Sunday evening to spend it with us here in New York. The book again, folks, is titled I-84-85, I'm sorry, the Show Me World Series. Marshall Garvey is the author. Pick that up. You really will enjoy it. And thank you for being with us, Marshall.
Thank you very much. Yeah, you can buy the book, Interstate 85, Royals, the Cardinals, and the Show Me World Series. You get it through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all major booksellers. Thank you all for your support. And, Bill, thank you so much for having me. It was a great chat.
Wonderful. Thank you, Marshall. That's Marshall Garvey, ladies and gentlemen. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk New York. I'd like to thank my guests, Art Shamsky, Chris Donnelly, Steve Ditmore, and Marshall Garvey, my engineer, Brian Graves, and, of course, you guys for joining us. I'll see you next on Sunday, August 3rd for more Sports Talk New York. Till then, be safe, be well. Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.